Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee for, it is not February 24th, I know that. It is March 3rd. Very good. Okay. So as we start, a quorum is present. I would like to read the safety notice. So to ensure a productive and safe environment where everyone can follow today's proceedings, we're asking all attendees to maintain a high standard of decorum. And here's what that means. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. To keep the focus on the testimony, please refrain from applause or any other audible demonstrations. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior are not permitted in the hearing room. To ensure we get to hear from everyone, testifiers should limit their remarks to the specified time limit, and we will let you know when you are at your time. For safety reasons, do not stand or sit in the aisles. If you need seating accommodations, please alert the sergeant staff wearing gold ties. If you were issued an entrance ticket, please keep it with you. You may need it for reentry should you leave the room. State troopers and sergeant staff are stationed throughout the room to ensure the safety of all. So thank you, everyone. So next order of business would be to move the minutes. And we have two sets of minutes. And so the first set is February 24th. And these minutes have been, are these the ones that we worked on? Yes. They are, yeah. So these had a little bit of confusion in them. Has anyone had a chance to read them and was prepared to move the minutes? Representative Feist.
I'll move the minutes and also compliment the font, which is fabulous. Thank you.
It's always important to have the right font. Thank you, Representative Feist. Is there any discussion to the minutes of February 4th? All right, seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Then we have minutes from February 26th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of February 26th? Representative Moeller?
So moved, Madam Chair, and I'm neutral on the font.
Okay. All right. The good thing we don't have to vote on the font. So is there any discussion to the minutes of February 26th? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and those minutes are approved. Thank you. All right. So, let's see, is this today's agenda? Oh, I've got it here. All right, the first bill that we're going to hear today is House File 3661. And this is Representative Gomez's bill that we did not get to the last time I had the gavel. But unfortunately, Representative Gomez is unable to be with us, so Representative Feist has agreed to present House File 3661, and so let's see. Representative Feist is going to move that House File 3661 be referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. There is an author's amendment, and did you want to move that at the outset, Representative Feist?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Do you want to... Does it bear explaining before we adopt it, or would you rather explain after it's adopted?
Seeing as Representative Gomez did not tell me about the amendment, I assume it's a technical amendment.
Okay.
So we can just discuss it in the larger bill.
Okay. I do think that the amendment is was based on recommendations from House Research. So let's go ahead and... So Representative Feist has moved the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? All in favor of adoption of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Feist to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. I would just like to mention that this is a bill that is near and dear to Chair Gomez's heart, and she was sorry that she couldn't be here today due to a conflict. It's a bill that she's introduced every term since she's been elected, and it has always been bipartisan in both bodies. So I'm really glad that we can continue the conversation today around facial recognition technology. It's really important and urgent conversation to be having. I'm concerned about the use of facial recognition technology because it has serious privacy ramifications, upending the right to be anonymous in public. It's akin to wearing a blown-up copy of your driver's license on the outside of your shirt in public with a GPS tracking device attached. Facial recognition systems are built on computer programs that analyze human faces for the purposes of identifying them. Unlike many other biometric systems, facial recognition can be used for general surveillance in combination with public video cameras, and it can be used in a passive way that does not require knowledge, consent, or participation of the subject. The biggest danger is that this technology will be used for widespread, secretive surveillance systems. Facial recognition surveillance represents an unprecedented threat to our privacy and our civil liberties. It gives governments the power to spy on us wherever they go, tracking our faces at protests, political rallies, places of worship, and more. Facial recognition technology has also repeatedly been found to be dangerously inaccurate, with serious racial and gender biases. The misidentification of a member in public in real life could lead to an encounter with law enforcement that could be deadly. I want to emphasize that there is at this moment no statewide regulation of facial recognition technology whatsoever. There are no guidelines for how and when government uses facial recognition technology. There are no limitations or protections on data sharing and data management. This is made even more worrisome when you realize how pervasive this technology has become. And I'll just mention that last night when I was preparing my bill presentation, I was watching Megan 2.0, which only like some people get. But anyway, I was just thinking about, wow, technology, sometimes we have good intentions, but it really gets out of hand. And it's our job as the legislature to really try to be as proactive as possible. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the experts and other testifiers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Feist. So the first testifier on the list is Chad Marlowe, Senior Policy Counsel for the ACLU, and I think this is he is appearing by Zoom. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Good morning. My name is Chad Marlowe, and I am an ACLU Senior Policy Counsel where I focus on privacy, surveillance, and technology issues. In the brief time I have, I want to make four observations in support of HF 3661's ban on the government use of facial recognition technology. Number one, concerns about facial recognition are nonpartisan. While each individual's reason for opposing facial recognition may vary, there is broad bipartisan consensus that allowing the government to identify people wherever they go in public, as well as those they meet with, undermines privacy and other core American rights. Number two, facial recognition technology suffers from significant accuracy issues. If you have any constituents who are persons of color, women, young persons, or senior citizens, you should be very worried about facial recognition because the technology is less accurate when it comes to identifying such persons, and its use is more likely to result in an unjustified stop or arrest. Testing conducted by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, or NIST, which facial recognition companies often cite as proof their technology is reliable and accurate, is extremely flawed and does not reflect how facial recognition technology is used in the real world. Number three, government use of facial recognition is increasing, especially with certain disfavored and vulnerable groups, such as immigrants, protesters, gun show attendees, persons of color, and low-income persons, which I imagine are constituencies many of you represent. The New York Times even reported a few weeks ago that the federal government is teaming up with the most notorious mass surveillance company, Palantir, and the ethically challenged facial recognition company, Clearview AI, to develop a mass surveillance program to identify and persecute immigrants and protesters. Once in place, it is highly unlikely that system's use will remain limited to those two groups. If Minnesota uses facial recognition technology, this terrifying new program is going to want its data. And number four, the manner in which facial recognition technology was rolled out in Minnesota did not provide space for sound policymaking. The best approach for rolling out a new surveillance technology is for elected officials to first learn about the technology, then to adopt legislation banning or governing its use, and finally, if permitted, the technology is deployed. Unfortunately, in Minnesota, the deployment step came first, and neither of the other steps followed. In light of these considerations, the governmental use of facial recognition technology should not be permitted in Minnesota. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony, and please do stay available in case there are questions. Next, we have Chris Wayland from Restore the Fourth, Minnesota. Welcome. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Chris Wayland. I am the chair of Restore the Fourth, Minnesota. I was also part of the, along with other local organizations, I was part of the Safety Not Surveillance Coalition, the coalition that pushed for the facial recognition municipal ban in Minneapolis back in 2020-2021. I'm not speaking for the coalition right now, but I'm going to crib very liberally from previous testimony that we've submitted on previous iterations of this bill. So the government use of this technology is a profound threat to our personal privacy and political and religious expression, primarily because it, as previously stated, it has the potential to be used to surveil us as we go about our daily lives. But one thing that I think wasn't mentioned is that there is no, unlike the surveillance tech that methods that were mentioned last week for geolocation and keyword search warrants, there isn't a built-in mechanism for individuals to opt out of the surveillance. We can't purchase a burner face or decide to walk instead of driving our cars or use a VPN when we search things. Our face is our face. We're stuck with it. Since the ordinance in 2021 in Minneapolis has passed, a lot of the arguments that we used in Minneapolis were based around some of the issues that were mentioned around disparate impacts, particularly when it comes to people of color, elders, and all that stuff. Many of those issues still remain. The state of the art of facial recognition has improved by leaps and bounds since then, but at the same time, this morning, I downloaded and ran a free and open source GitHub repository, like a thing to build a local facial recognition tool, and the tool couldn't tell the difference between me and Joe Biden. It was able to figure out that I wasn't Barack Obama, but that's not saying terribly much. The point is that we have no standards around which, you know, what is Hennepin County using to, because Hennepin County uses facial recognition tech, but there isn't any known way that we have. Are they using that sort of terrible Python code that I downloaded this morning? Are they using more state-of-the-art system? There's no standards around the quality of the tech. And absent any kind of state regulation, any kind of quality controls, any kind of public disclosure laws, any kind of mechanisms to solicit community input around whether or not local law enforcement should have access to this tech, just ban it. Start from a position of saying no. Say, if you want to use this stuff, demand specific use policies and demand mechanisms around accountability and quality. But in the interim period, until all of those details are worked out, you should not have access to this tech. And that should, and that broad rule should apply to all forms of new surveillance technology. There's no reason why, until the specifics around how and when and under what circumstances are, there's no reason for law enforcement or the government to have access to these tools until the legislature or some local form of body has like specified these are the conditions around its use. So thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony.
Yeah.
Next we have Major Spencer Bakke. Hennepin County Sheriff's Office. Welcome to the committee. You would please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Liebling. My name is Spencer Bakke, and I currently serve as a major with the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office. For more than 15 years, I led our Criminal Intelligence Division and our Criminal Information Sharing and Analysis Unit. including as a captain and lieutenant. During that time, I was responsible for the oversight of facial recognition technology for the Sheriff's Office. I appreciate the opportunity to share how we approach this technology and what we believe responsible use looks like. Our facial recognition technology policy has been provided to the committee. If you look at section 801.7, our policy clearly states facial recognition is never used as positive identification. It is only an investigative lead. Any result must be independently corroborated by other investigative methods before it can be acted on. A facial recognition investigative lead is not probable cause to arrest. Second, we do not use facial recognition, for surveillance as it is typically defined for ongoing tracking or supervision. Our system is not connected to cameras, cannot be used for real-time monitoring, and is never used to scan the public or track individuals. It is primarily used as a criminal after a criminal incident has occurred, using suspect images obtained as part of an investigation. We then compare the suspect photo to our booking photo repository. From there, trained analysts examine and verify the results prior to sending investigative leads to investigators. From our perspective, the preferred approach is not eliminating the tool entirely, but clearly defining how it may and may not be used. The benefits of this technology in the form of public safety are extremely substantial. Investigatory tasks that would take countless hours, like going through large databases of photos by hand, can be accomplished at a fraction of the time. And while facial recognition is never used as a positive identification, it is an excellent tool for ruling out suspects who are innocent and would otherwise be investigated if not for the lack of facial recognition results. Our agency has used this technology in hundreds of investigations over the past year. This has included identifying, recovering, and rescuing victims of human trafficking, criminal sexual conduct offenses, helping identify murderers, and recovering stolen assault rifles. These are just some of the examples where these investigative leads assisted with solving crimes and helping victims. This tool is just that, a tool, but it is an important one that can and should be used in accordance with lawful constitutional investigations. An outright ban on the use of facial recognition by law enforcement is not our preferred approach. Such a ban deprives the public and victims of the benefits of this technology. As one of the few agencies that uses this technology, we encourage the legislature to review our policy and think about safeguards and statutory framework that would provide the right balance between privacy and public safety. And we welcome the chance to work with the author and legislators to accomplish these goals. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Those are the testifiers that we had on the list. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead and we'll have 2 minutes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I am an open government and privacy advocate for decades here at the state legislature. I was in the forefront of the facial recognition issues for a number of years, ever since they first appeared at the Super Bowl. So I was inquiring of law enforcement through data request about what Minnesota is doing. It broke loose when Tony Webster sued Hennepin County. And then we found out, like we've always found out over many years, new toys, new technology, law enforcement adopts it, uses it, and we don't know anything about it, particularly the policymakers. So what has happened since then, there's basically, BCA doesn't have this, as best as I know from talking with Drew Evans, but CISA does. So multi-thousands of scans have been done through CISA since about 2014, 2015, that a law enforcement agency will go to CISA and say, hey, we got this picture. Can you do a scan? Can you give us some info? I've done many data requests on this, and I got a public list of all the agencies that did it, so I did multi-data requests. What I am suggesting now for improvement of this bill, because as no one being around here for years, I know the reality that this bill is not going to go choo-choo a lot. But That's my own point of view. I share that. I support the bill, but I just know some of the reality. But I want something to happen. So these are my four suggestions. One, each agency develop a facial recognition policy, like St. Paul has done, which is, St. Paul's is pretty good. Also, like as you know, with technology, with body cams and LPRs, license plate readers, you put a note, it's part of the record. So the record should state that there should, that we use facial recognition. When I looked at these cases, it was all over the board, and they didn't say they were using FR for recognition, but they were. A task force be done. And then as I entered the building, and I sometimes ask Captain Roski this issue, hey, are you using facial recognition in the cameras at the Capitol? And whatever, but he said, I think he says no, but if they are, this is to my fourth point, let's have a notice of all public buildings that use facial recognition posted, sort of like at the Mall of America. When you go in the mall, that you know that they're using facial recognition. Madam Chair, co-chairs, once again, you know, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? All right, seeing none, we'll close the testimony and open it up for member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of justifying Mr. Neumeister's choo-choo prophecy, I'm going to request a roll call vote.
Okay, roll call having been requested. There will be a roll call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there is something inherently icky about facial recognition. I've had this conversation. I believe you and I have talked about it, and I know I've talked to Gomez about it on multiple occasions. In fact, I think at one point I might actually have been signed onto this bill or a previous iteration of it. Looking at it today, however, the issue that I see is that we're talking about a blanket ban on an entire category of technology, regardless of its current or future state of development and what potential utilizations it could have in the future. I think that that's an overreach in terms of a response, especially when it seems to be a preemptive response to a problem that hasn't yet manifested itself. A couple of times during presentation today, we've heard references to the idea of maintaining anonymity in public. And of course, we know there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in public. That's what being in public means. It's an interesting contrast to the conversation we had on the floor yesterday regarding the masking of federal agents and the fact that it is, in current statute, illegal for people to wear masks without certain causes, certain just causes in the public. And so we already kind of have this idea in statute that we want to know who you are when you're walking around in public, generally speaking. And this kind of reminds me of, none of us were there, I don't think, but it kind of reminds me of the dawn of fingerprint technology and its implementation. And I imagine if there was a conversation, sometime in 1892 when this was first, fingerprinting was first utilized to secure a conviction in a criminal case that was in Argentina, if there was some sort of philosophical conversation about whether or not this is okay, whether or not this is a justifiable use of this technology, whether or not it can be trusted, the potential error rates and things of that nature, all of which have been worked out over time, and it's now very much in common use. And so I would suggest that, similar to what Mr. Neumeister and the testifier from the Sheriff's Department indicated, that if our concern is about the admissibility of evidence developed from facial recognition technology, we should try to take a more surgical approach to developing standards around how such evidence could be used admissibly in court cases. Look at how these elements come together, compare and contrast with analogous things that have come in the past, and look at those precedents in terms of how privacy applies to those versus how a proper chain of evidence, proper investigation, proper admissibility should be regarded in judicial proceedings, and come up with a more targeted approach. Thank you.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this question might be for Major Bakke, but maybe someone else knows the answer. We did see his policy, and Mr. Neumeister mentioned St. Paul has a policy. Do we know if other law enforcement agencies have policies around this?
Welcome back, Major Bakke. If you would go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you, Co-Chair, committee members. I am aware that there are other policies out there, but I don't have the information of who has those policies or how many exist in the state at this time.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I assume there's no post, board policy. It's just up to each law enforcement agency if they're going to have
Bakke.
This.
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, correct.
Yep. Great.
Representative Moeller?
Yeah, thank you. I'm done with the questions and just a couple of comments. You know, these bills that limit technology over the years, I've been somewhat uncomfortable with them because of the use in for law enforcement.
Major Bakke, if you could just stay there for a second, because I have a question for you, too. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I've been uncomfortable with some of these bills. This is maybe I'm just not meant to speak today.
Apologize for all the interruptions.
I'll try again. Thank you. So I have been generally uncomfortable with many of these bills because of the use for law enforcement and prosecution. However, seeing how this technology is being used now at the federal level is very alarming to me, and I appreciated the ACLU's testimony about that. And I really think I've come to the point now where risks of misuse of this technology outweighs the benefits. And Representative Hudson, I think it's not just about the admissibility of evidence, it's the actual collection of this information and then how it can be used. As my favorite artist, Taylor Swift, says, this is why we can't have nice things, is because of the misuse of that technology. So, you know, if this bill gets limited in some ways, I think that's fine. But I just really do worry about once this is collected, how it's being used. And once it's out, the cat is out of the bag, and it can't be put back in the bag again. So thank you for bringing this bill on behalf of Chair Gomez. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist, for showing up for Rep. Gomez today. I know she was really sad that she couldn't be in front of the committee today, so thank you for taking it on. I just wanted first to say I know that ahead of today's committee, Chair Gomez was on a schedule for a different day, and that committee took too long, and we weren't able to get to her. And I say that because this bill today wasn't a surprise. You know, as you mentioned, Representative Gomez has been championing this topic for years. And I would hope that in the time when we're scheduling bills and they're coming before us, that we would have conversations about that, that we would write amendments to make a bill better if we're interested in doing that work and collaborating. Sometimes we don't have ample time to do that. I think in this case, we definitely did. We had a whole weekend. And so in the greater context of a lot of the bills that we're talking about, that's sort of, you know, we have some lines blurred of what rights are and what certain groups should have access to or who shouldn't have access to it. There's a couple of themes that I just want to jump back to here. And one is, bills like this, as you noted, Rep. Gomez has had this for years. While it may seem, and it is, a very timely discussion, this isn't something that's just in response to or a knee-jerk reaction to anything that has happened recently. This is work that has been worked on for years in hopes that it could have curbed the activity that we've seen recently. And so, you know, I wish that legislators in the past had taken the time to have those conversations too. But we're here and that's our job. And so I hope that as we talk about this, that folks are willing to come to the table with amendments on ideas that we may disagree on to do the best that we can. I'll also say that, you know, when we are talking about bills like this, it's not about who's in power at the time. And this is something that I see as, you know, of course, sitting where I am, who I am, based on constituent input, not a big fan of the federal administration right now, right? And so I fear of what they might do with this technology. However, I think that same fear is totally legitimate and valid for folks on the other side. when there's a power shift at the federal level and who don't trust and don't feel comfortable. And so I do see bills like this as really looking forward to protect all of us, regardless of who's in power, similar to the long bill that we've discussed. And I do just want to note that, you know, the technology being used, we know the sort of groups that it has affected highly recently. And again, I just want to urge people to think about once the technology is no longer needed for that particular group, is your group next? Mm-hmm. Think about that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So we have a number of members on the list, and was kind of hoping to wrap up this bill somewhat soon, so I just would ask members to be brief. And let me just ask my quick question so that Major Bakke can go back to his seat. I just wondered if Hennepin County has a data retention policy on this. I didn't hear anything about how the data is stored, retained, deleted.
Yes, we do have a sheriff's office data retention schedule that would oversee the storage and retention of much of the data, if it's criminal investigative data, you know, private or public data. The system that we utilize, again, the suspect photo, let's just say it's from a outside law enforcement agency requesting our assistance, we would again put that into our system. We would retain it in that system as long as it's an active ongoing investigation or after a period of 5 years. If there's no accessing it and it's stale information, that information will be destroyed as part of our annual records audit that we conduct each year.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay, next on the list we have Representative Durant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask the bill author, is there an issue right now that we are trying to curve because something's happening with inside the state of Minnesota with either law enforcement or anywhere else? And then my second question, to hurry this up, is were the stakeholders involved with making this bill? I mean, because we were talking about, and I actually like what Representative Kerr said, was, bringing in the stakeholders and talking about this. Has the bill author actually talked to any law enforcement agencies that would actually be able to give her some advice in regards to making this bill better? I mean, where is that input? Because right now this is just an all right ban on things, and without, you know, having the actual input of local law enforcement, how this tool could actually be used properly is something I think is necessary. So can you answer those for me, please?
Representative Feist.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions. So the issue that we're trying to address, like we were talking about just the other day, like there's Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota State Constitution, which mirrors the Fourth Amendment, that we all have a constitutional right against an unreasonable, like, searches and seizures. And the use of facial recognition technology without any guardrails or policies whatsoever, in my mind, it violates that constitutional right that we all have. But more practically speaking, what this leads to and the reason that we have those rights, the reason why our framers wanted them in our Constitution, was because it can lead to false arrests. It leads to general warrantless surveillance of innocent people, especially when you're pairing that technology up with, like, drones, for example, or automatic license plate readers. We heard about how, like, all of the different types of surveillance tools can work in connection with one another, and that can lead to a lot of surveillance that we haven't consented to. And that constant data sharing, the fact that, like, at the state level anyway, we don't have data retention rules, those are all problems that I believe it's our responsibility to, like, try to proactively address. I have not been involved with Chair Gomez. She's been here longer than me. I know that she is incredibly collaborative on the work she does. I know that she is a deep thinker. And I know that a lot of work has gone into thinking about this issue and just general surveillance issues. She and I both feel really passionate about that. And I'm sure that she'd be really interested in having some additional conversations. I hate to speak for her. I don't specifically know. I haven't been in the room during all of the bill development.
Okay. Thank you. And Major, you could go back to your seat if you wish. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing this for Rep. Gomez. I do share in a lot of the concerns that you guys have across the aisle. I think AI, technology, all of the advancements that we've seen, we can't fully grasp it. And we want to make sure that it works for us instead of the other way around. And I am fearful of that. But sometimes I think we have a knee-jerk reaction to simply want to ban something to fully grasp that that issue that we can't curtail, rather than see how we can make it work for us. And in cases where human traffickers, where murderers, the worst amongst us, when they're caught using this technology, that is a way in which it's working for us. That's a way that we don't want to prevent, and one that I definitely don't want to ban outright. While I'm encouraged that the bill author is willing to have some of those discussions, I just think that the amendment and the bill as it currently stands is not going to work to prevent that from being excluded from our use. So look forward to continued conversations. I think this is definitely needed when it comes to putting some guardrails around that Big Brother society that we all want to prevent. But until we can get this thing in a position where everybody's on board with it and it's workable, I think I'm going to have to be a no. So thank you.
Okay, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. And thank you to Gomez, who is not here, but who is a very diligent at this job, and I'm sure has been having every conversation imaginable. Most of what I wanted to say has been said, so I'll be short. I just would like us to imagine. I appreciate everything Representative Engen just said, and I want to reflect back on Representative Hudson's comments. And I would just like us to imagine a world or imagine a technology where we decided to do the things that we have to do to get the answers, to use it responsibly before we used it for everything. I think what you're saying is correct. We have to figure out how to use it responsibly. And as the testimony from ACLU said, we have to start by withholding broad, unregulated action so that we can figure out how to use it responsibly. It is the natural state of the legislature to chase technology that is out of control. That is where we live. I just came from a hearing where we talked about crypto regulation. I'm working on AI regulation. Every single technology, fingerprinting technology apparently, we have to chase it down to try to control it after it is out of control. And this one specifically seems to me like anything we can do to maybe get ahead of it before we reach that Big Brother society would be great. China has 700 million facial surveillance cameras in their country. That's twice as many people as we have in this entire country. Like, that's where we're going. This technology is unregulated. It is also commercially available. I don't think this bill is broad enough. I don't want people purchasing this commercially to use in their businesses. We should jump forward instead of chasing. That's all.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this committee agrees more on the pathway for this than we disagree. And I think, as you all know, I have concerns about living in a surveillance society. That's not what people in a free country, that's not how we live. I'm wondering if the major would come back for one. I'm glad you did not leave, Major. Thank you for sticking around. It's helpful.
Exercise.
Yeah. And I really do appreciate that Hennepin County has a written policy. And I'll just preface before I get to the question, I will say I agree with the gentleman from the ACLU that actually maybe we need to draft a bill that just says, law enforcement, if you get new technology, you can't use it until you get a policy in place with the legislature. Maybe that's what we have to do at this point. Because, Mr. Neumeister, as you know, Stingray, we didn't even know that existed until a member of the public found out. So I'm tired of playing catch up, but that's what we're doing here. Representative Curran, to your to your comments about we had the weekend to work on it. I worked on body cameras. I worked on ALPRs. It is not a weekend project. It is hours and hours and days of negotiation. But the good thing about having those technology policies already in place is that we have a framework to work from. Major Bakke, I know Chair Liebling asked you about your data retention. What do you do with the non-investigatory, like the non-hit data? What do you do with that? How long do you keep that?
So I think you understand the question correctly. If we are given a suspect photo that turns out to be somebody that's not involved in the case, is that kind of following?
Yes.
Yeah, then we, as soon as that information is relayed to us, if it's part of maybe an external investigation by another agency, we would purge that data, or we would go through again in our annual review. We do a records audit each year specifically for data in facial recognition system. And at that time, we would go through and purge the data.
Manager. Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so another thing that you mentioned there in passing is we have, because you have this technology, how many requests do you get annually since you've had this technology from other law enforcement agencies to run a photo through your facial recognition technology?
Yeah, I did bring some numbers with me. I don't have it broken down on hand by which agency made the request, but I can tell you that for 2025, we had 809 instances where we used this technology for investigative assistance, and we generated 335 investigative leads. So a little less than half resulted in an investigative lead being sent to the investigating agency.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that information. I'm glad you had that with you. That's really helpful. And this is all part of a policy piece that we're going to have to determine and grapple with, is do we allow them to share this technology? I have been a co-author on a complete ban on this before. I did not sign the bill this year or recently because I knew it has to be more nuanced. And, you know, if a member of my family was missing, I would want to be able to use this technology. But I think the cases for its use have to be limited. And I think probably most everybody around this table would agree with that. So I can't support the bill today, but I think we all agree that that more work needs to be done, and we do need to address this technology. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you, members. So I'm going to make a brief comment, and then I'll let Representative Feist close up here. But I think there is substantial agreement, Chair Scott, and I'm always glad that we do have that agreement around some of these issues. And I think everyone can see that this issue does need more work. This isn't like a one and done, and this bill, like many bills, isn't perfect. And that's why we have a committee process, and that's why the bill is being re-referred to public safety, so that more work can be done. And the work that needs to be done in particular is around what the guardrails are and what the uses are in particular for law enforcement. But, you know, since we're taking a roll call vote on this, everybody has to take like one side or the other, right? And I think that those of us who are going to vote to pass the bill along to public safety, I think it kind of goes back to what Chair Moeller was talking about. We are in a situation where we are seeing the real problems. This is like not a thing in the future. This is now, and it is serious. And there was some discussion earlier about, well, you go out in public and you're in public, but this kind of technology has changed what it means to be in public. And I was just thinking, what would the founder say? You know, when the Fourth Amendment was written, who ever thought that there would be this kind of ability to see and track? And this is, it's just whole other opening cans of worms, and I'm sure there will be more that we can't even imagine. So, yes, Chair Scott, I think we probably need to have something more comprehensive. This bill surely isn't perfect, but I think it's good enough to move to the other committee. And I just want to remind members, when you vote on a bill in committee, you are not saying, yes, this is the bill I want forever and ever. You are saying, I am agreeing to move this to another committee so that it can be seen and discussed in that committee. So thank you. Representative Feist, final word.
Yep, thank you so much. So usually a lot of democracy happens behind the scenes, but I'm just thinking out loud here. I feel like this has been a really productive conversation. I'm reminded of the bill that I worked on that was bipartisan around cell phone policies in schools, where, you know, we had sort of like a draconian idea that just like banned them. And it didn't feel like, A, that could pass, or B, that was a good idea. And what we came up with was just requiring schools across the state to come up with their own policy that worked for their students, their communities, their priorities. And it's been really successful. And it was a way that we, the state, could, you know, say, like, this is important without saying, like, this is how you should do it. And I personally am really I like the Hennepin County policy. I also thought that Rich Neumeister had some good ideas. Like, I feel like this is a bill we could pass in some form this year. And so I am proposing, without talking to anyone at all, like that we continue this conversation, that Representative Engen, I know you are passionate about this issue. Representative Hudson, I know you are too. Like what if we took off the roll call and we just moved it with the understanding that it is not – like going to pass in this form and it's not ready, you know, to pass, like we are not as a body ready to pass it into law as it exists, but we move it to public safety. And in the meantime, conversations can be had with more stakeholders. Like, I feel like, unlike our negotiations yesterday, Rep. Steer and Rep. Duran, about my House File 103, where I was like, I feel like I'm banging my head against a wall. I don't know where we're going to go with that. Like, I feel like there are options here that are going to strike the right balance. So that's my proposal. And Rep. Hudson, you can say no, and we can all vote on it on the record. But just throwing it out there that maybe we could pass it to public safety today with bipartisan support.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I always appreciate, Representative Feist, your willingness to collaborate. My understanding is that there's a clone version of this bill that's currently sitting in public safety. So the opportunity is there for us to take a look at it. As far as the current state of this bill, I think we'll retain the roll call. Thank you.
All right, a roll call having been requested, clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Chair Liebling, aye. Chair Scott.
No.
Chair Scott, no. Vice Chair Finke.
Aye.
Finke, aye. Vice Chair Hudson.
Nope.
Hudson, no. Representative Bliss.
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Curran, aye. Representative Duran.
No.
Duran, no. Representative Engen.
No.
Engen, no. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Mahmoud.
Aye.
Mahmoud, aye. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Rarick. Excused. Representative Steer.
No.
Steer, no.
Yeah, there being seven ayes and six nays, under the rules of the committee, the motion does not prevail and the bill does not advance. So we will move now. Thank you very much, Representative Feist. We will move now to House File 2380, Representative Hicks. Sir, we are running considerably behind, so we're going to try as best we can to be concise, if everyone can do that. So welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2380, since Representative Hicks is not on the committee. And there is a delete everything amendment. And it is, and the bill is going to be moved to the general register. That is the motion. And I will move the DE1 amendment that is in your packets. And Representative Hicks, if you'd tell us about the DE1.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. The DE really does just change the bill
to make sure that it is workable within our current system and to pair it more fully with the current requirements that we have, while also strengthening the ability for accommodations to be the lack of participating in active accommodations to be considered discriminatory.
Okay, so any discussion to the amendment before we adopt it? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So any other comment to the bill as amendment, Representative Hicks?
No, Chair. I do have testifiers, so I will be quiet so that folks who are directly impacted by this bill can share with you why they believe it to be important.
Wonderful. Thank you. So first on the list, we have Ellen Smart from the Disability Law Center. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony. And we're going to ask everyone to please limit your testimony to 2 minutes if you can.
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott, members of the committee, my name is Ellen Smart. I'm a staff attorney at Legal Aid in the Minnesota Disability Law Center. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning in favor of House File 2380. This is more than just a symbolic act to enshrine disability rights in our state's Human Rights Act. Disability rights are actively being eroded at the federal level right now. I'll give you two examples. Executive Order 14281, signed last year, mandated that the federal government end the practice of recognizing disparate impact discrimination under federal rights civil laws.
Ms. Smart, could you move the mic a little bit closer to your mouth?
Sorry.
Thank you.
So Executive Order 14281, signed last year, mandated that the federal government end the practice of recognizing disparate impact discrimination under federal civil rights laws, making it more difficult to enforce laws like the Rehabilitation Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. Currently, there is a lawsuit, Texas versus Kennedy, in which 9 states are trying to invalidate protections provided under a federal law, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. Section 504 says that if a program receives federal money, that it cannot discriminate against people with disabilities. The 9 states named in the lawsuit are taking aim at the right of individuals to live in the most integrated settings possible, putting people with disabilities at serious risk of institutionalization. If Texas versus Kennedy is successful, not only are we likely to see a return of institutions, people with disabilities could be excluded from education, healthcare, housing, and services. School districts could decide not to provide accommodations for students with disabilities. Hospitals could decide not to provide accessible medical equipment. We can make moves to stop this harm at Minnesota's borders. Supporting this bill and others this session can ensure that Minnesotans with disabilities retain protections and rights that have been built over the past 50 years. Specifically, this bill would require that accommodations be made no matter what happens in Texas versus Kennedy. Please support this bipartisan bill to ensure that this erosion of rights stops at Minnesota's borders. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Jillian Nelson from the Autism Society of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. If you would please tell us your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Jillian Nelson, and I'm the policy director at the Autism Society of Minnesota. I'm also a disabled adult. It was not until 1973 and the 504 Act, the Rehabilitation Act, that people with disabilities have basic civil rights to access public service. It's now 2026, and Minnesotans with disabilities do not yet have the right to accommodations guaranteed in Minnesota statute. House File 2380 can change that. It upholds promises that were made to people with disabilities decades ago that are currently under attack in the current federal political theatrics. Promises that in our state are nonpartisan and just common sense. People with disabilities are valuable members of our community. Our culture as a state is not one that would allow us to leave Minnesotans with disabilities unprotected and without civil rights. Access to accommodations is about more than just a convenience. It is the gateway to living independently in the community. Without accommodations, we lose access to education, healthcare, transportation, employment, and more. Without accommodations, we increase the dependence on social services and decrease self-direction, and inevitably, we will return to the antiquated systems of mass institutionalization. We have long been a role model in this country for disability rights, and this once again gives us a chance to be a catalyst and lead the way for other states to codify 504 protections at a state level. I rewrote this sentence. Minnesota has a chance today to make sure that citizens like me do not live in fear, that a court in Texas can rule against the 504 Act, and in a single moment, I lose my basic civil rights. I rewrote this a dozen times, trying to accurately quantify the feeling of living in that shadow, waiting for that decision. The fear, the uncertainty, to know that I can go from the life I fought for to being back in an institution because we trusted that a federal law was enough to protect Minnesota. I don't know how to explain it. And even more, I don't know how I would explain it to the countless people with disabilities in our community that do not realize that this could happen to us. So today, right now, let's make sure that we don't ever have to tell those who are most vulnerable in our community that they no longer have the right to accommodation, that no one has to include them, educate them, house them, treat them, support them. Let's make sure that we don't ever have to tell them that they don't belong here. Please support the DEA amendment and include House File 2380 in the omnibus. This may very well be a piece of legislation that we never need to depend on, but also, it may very well be one of the single most important things you do in your career. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Joel Runnels from the Minnesota Council on Disability. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
Morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joel Runnels, and I serve with Minnesota Council on Disabilities. I self-identify as a person with a disability. Specifically, I stutter. And so I might, if speaking slow, need a little more than the two-minute limit. Minnesota State Council is a state agency which serves as a liaison between Minnesotans with disabilities and their elected officials, all of you. We advise on disability policy matters across employment, housing, public services, public accommodation, and education. This legislature has long recognized that freedom from discrimination is fundamental to democracy. Section 363A.02 of the Minnesota Human Rights Act affirms that all individuals are entitled to full and equal participation in employment, housing, education, and public life, free from discrimination based on disability. HF 2380 would clarify in Minnesota Statute 363A.02 the public policy section of this act, that reasonable accommodations enable people with disabilities to participate fully in the areas that law protects, and that failure to engage in the process to determine an appropriate accommodation may itself constitute an unfair discriminatory practice. So by placing this legislation in the public policy section, the bill reinforces legislative intent regarding meaningful access and participation. For many Minnesotans with disabilities, myself included, discrimination does not take the form of overt exclusion. And one reason it might not is that a significant amount of disabilities are invisible. So when folks, assuming you saw me walk in and seat here, it's not like a movie where you can scan an x-ray and see that I stutter. So more often, this kind of discrimination appears as a breakdown in communication when a reasonable accommodation request is not meaningfully considered, whether it's in employment, housing, education, or public services. The interactive process is how equal opportunity becomes real in practice. HF 2380 does not create a new protected class, expand covered areas, or establish a new cause of action. Rather, it clarifies expectations around good faith and engagement in determining reasonable accommodations, an expectation already reflected in disability law and practice. Clear statutory language supports consistent interpretation, provides guidance to cover to covered entities, and reduces ambiguity that can lead to unnecessary disputes. Most importantly, this clarification helps ensure that Minnesotans with disabilities are not denied meaningful access because accommodation requests were not addressed, while also providing employers, landlords, schools, and public entities clearer direction on how to comply with law. As many of you know, Minnesota has periodically updated its Human Rights Act to reflect evolving legal standards, and most importantly, our lived experiences of the 1 in 4 Minnesotans who have a disability. 1 in 4. HF 2380 continues that work by reinforcing that meaningful access is central to equal protection under the law. So for these reasons, Minnesota Council on Disability supports HF 2380. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next we have Tina Rucci from the ARC Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Am I close enough to the mic?
I think so.
Okay, great. So my name is Tina Rucci. I'm the Public Policy Director at the ARC Minnesota. The ARC Minnesota is a nonprofit organization devoted since 1950 to the promotion and protection of the human rights of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, which I'll be referring to as IDD. Throughout the years, this mission has manifested itself through various initiatives focused on working with individuals with IDD, their families, and those who work to support them in accessing necessary services, building autonomy, and developing as leaders in their communities. The ARC Minnesota would like to express its sincere concern over the federal case Texas versus Kennedy. If successful, as my colleagues mentioned, this lawsuit targeting the integration mandate in Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 would be a devastating blow to people with disabilities. We urge your defense of Section 504, one of the longest established disability civil rights laws in this country. The 9 states involved in this lawsuit claim that the integration mandate in Section 504 is unconstitutional, but the ARC Minnesota strongly disagrees. Through more than 75 years of working with people with IDD and their families, we've seen that individuals lead more fulfilling lives when they are supported to live, work, and participate in their communities. If successful, Texas versus Kennedy would place disabled people at risk by making it easier to return to segregated settings, away from their families and support networks. Removing the integration mandate would violate the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Olmstead decision, both of which require services to be provided in the most integrated setting possible. These protections exist to prevent people with disabilities from being isolated in institutions. For much of the 20th century, thousands of people with IDD were confined to large remote facilities where many people faced unsafe conditions, loss of privacy and choice, and neglect or abuse.
I have to ask you to please wrap up.
Okay. One last sentence, Madam Chair. This era represents one of the darkest chapters in our nation's history. We need to listen to people with disabilities, and we cannot go back. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Does anyone from the public wish to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Roger Day. I'll try to take a seat here. Like one of the previous testifiers, I have a communication disability that impairs my capacity to deliver speedy commentary. I have to choose my words very slowly and carefully, and it ends up taking a long time to make sure that what I say comes across with the utmost fidelity. And so I hope you'll be patient as I testify here. I am a person with a, not only with a disability, but with another category of discrimination. I qualify as a person under discrimination, under subdivision 1C or 1. Paragraphs 3, 4, and 5. I've been experiencing education sex discrimination for 35 years. There is a fraud occurring at the University of Minnesota that is a sex-based hate crime upon me and upon the world. So that is the first form of discrimination that I experience is a sex discrimination in education. But on top of that, that discrimination has caused me profound disability. And as I have sought accommodation for my profound disability, I have been abused in the accommodation determination process.
Dr. Day, that is 2 minutes. I'll give you one more minute. But wrap
and
it up.
So I think the most important thing to do here is to change the wording on page 2, line 4, from may be to is. Right now, my requests for process to determine accommodation are being obstructed in the Minnesota judiciary, in the Attorney General's office, in the governor's office, and in the legislature. I was receiving a disability accommodation from the legislative auditor a couple years ago, and when the content of my reporting became uncomfortable for the state, my accommodation was yanked, and I have not been able to continue to provide information to the legislative auditor's office. There is a massive fraud taking place in the matter of my education and in the matter of my professional identity. I've been a 35-year subject of Minnesota forensic investigation, and the state is performing fraudulently in that investigation.
Dr. Day, we need to move on. Thank you
for
your testimony.
So it is very important that we accommodate people's disabilities, and when we don't engage in the process, it's not just maybe discriminatory, it is.
Thank you.
It's a crime. We need to change the language on line 4.
Thank you.
To is.
Okay, is there any other member of the public who wishes to testify on the bill? All right, seeing none, we'll close the testimony. Is there discussion on the bill? Oh, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And had some really just some questions for the bill's author. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for being here. I'm a little perplexed about this language, and I noticed the first draft you put actually in section 363A, where it is a 0.19, where it's entitled Discrimination Against Persons with Disabilities Prohibited. And if you read that language, I would just direct members to House File 2380 and that first paragraph, and it says an entity must provide reasonable accommodations to an individual with a disability and must ensure no individual with a disability is discriminated against by the entity. So I'm looking at that language, and I mean, this whole section talks about not discriminating against someone with a disability, and I'm a little puzzled as why you took your DE or the amendment goes and puts it in the policy statement. Could you enlighten us a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Absolutely, Chair Scott. I really appreciate that question. so the previous version of this bill last year, it didn't really do what I was hoping to do. So I worked in the interim with our stakeholders, including people with disabilities, many of whom testified today. We had some other folks here, but because of time, they had to leave, so that is unfortunate. To change what we were doing to really what the heart of what we were trying to do. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that refusal to participate in the accommodations process may be considered discriminatory. And the reason that the language is may is because it isn't always, right? I don't like absolutes, and I'm trying really hard to really be not use absolutes when it's not appropriate. And in this case, that is the situation. And so we already have some of the strongest anti-discriminatory language in the country. What this does is saying refusal to participate in the accommodations process could by itself be considered discriminatory.
Chair Scott?
Thank you. And thanks for that answer. And I don't know if there's anyone here from the Department of Human Rights. Is there anyone in the room? Doesn't look like it. I'm just puzzled still, because if a person believes that their request for an accommodation wasn't taken seriously, would they not have a case before the Department of Human Rights? They could take that to the Department of Human Rights and have a case, right?
Potentially.
Representative Scott.
Thank
you. I'm sorry, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Potentially. It would sort of depend on the merits of that case, but the piece that this adds is that the refusal to participate in that process in the actual accommodations could be considered discriminatory. And so accommodations are a weird dance between a person with a disability and whoever they're requesting it from, right? There isn't a rule that says you must take my accommodation. That's not what accommodations mean. Accommodations mean it is an interactive process with the other person. And sometimes what happens is you request an accommodation and the person goes, no. And the process sort of ends. And so that could be discriminatory depending on what the request was and where in the process. What this language does is really clarify and codify that that process, that dance, is necessary, because if you choose to not engage in that dance, it could be discriminatory. And the department is neutral on this. The way that the language is currently written in law has some protections, and we're grateful for those. What we come to you today as people with disabilities, is say we'd like a little bit more, and that's why we have worked together to author this bill.
Jessica?
Thank you. So, did I have a follow-up?
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry,
please.
Do you think I waved you away?
Yes.
I'm saying, yeah, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I still don't see or hear in your answer that someone wouldn't have a case before the Department of Human Rights. They could take it if the department determined that it, in your case, you weren't even a may. I mean, the rest of the statute says must.
Yeah.
If, in my mind, you already have grounds for taking a potential case to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, stating your case, having an investigation done if the department believes that there's that an investigation needs to be done. I don't see the necessity for this language. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Scott.
May I respond,
yes,
Chair? Thank you. Yes. I appreciate that. And I understand that it may not be clear to someone who doesn't frequently have to do that dance. As someone who has done that dance a lot, that's a valid point. As someone who has done that dance a lot in their lives and who has supported a lot of people doing that dance and a lot of children and the folks that came to you today, what I'm trying to get across, and maybe I'm not doing a very good job, is that that process as it currently stands is really challenging to navigate and isn't accessible. And people with disabilities are saying to you that they feel like adding this language would help them reduce discriminations across all aspects of their life. And necessity should be coming from the folks who are saying it's necessary. And that's what this community is saying. That's what we're asking for together as a coalition.
Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Hicks, not only for this bill, but for all of your life's work to support the disability community. To me, this is an opportunity. We've had discussions about how a lot of our actions at the state and federal levels affect people with disabilities who often get lost in the conversation. To me, this is an easy win for the community. And so much so that I would love to put my vote on the record in favor, and I request a roll call. Thank you.
All right, a roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I think it would be 100% easy to say that I would put every single dollar that everybody around this table hates discrimination against anybody with a disability, and we find that to be vile, and we want there to be ramifications for having done so. But when you take a look at your language, this is, I think, a roundabout way of potentially going after Chapter 14C. I want to know how that would interact with your bill as it currently stands, and whether or not the U.S. Department of Labor would then not be able to permit certifications for day providers here in Minnesota who provide opportunities for folks who have a disability and might not be able to work in a setting that otherwise they'd like to. It gets them into the door. It provides them that socialization and opportunities to meet others before then going into a workplace setting. And I think that inadvertently you might be outright banning that with your bill. Do you know if that's something that could potentially happen?
Representative Hicks.
To be fair, I absolutely believe in competitive integrated employment and do not love subminimum wages for people with disabilities to be paid 14 cents an hour so that for-profit DHS providers who receive 15-minute increment funding from Medicaid to provide those services can then get contracts with businesses that they overcharge those contracts for so they can pay people with disabilities less. Totally a thing. Absolutely. 100% against that. However, that's not what this does. This just says accommodations allow people with disabilities to participate in these areas of protection. Failure to engage in the process to determine an accommodation may be considered discriminatory. It says may, and it is about accommodations. 14C providers are already exempt under federal law from being forced to follow a variety of things around prevailing wage, fair wage, discrimination around wage repression. I mean, you want to talk about 14C, we do that all day long. But that is not the purpose of this. This is about access to accommodations. I don't have some kind of magic gotcha. I really want to hurt DHS, Medicaid providers. Like, that's not what I'm doing. I'm literally just trying to get people with disabilities to be heard when they say, we are afraid, we are scared, we do not feel like we can consistently engage in the accommodation process, and we're asking for protection.
Thank you. Representative Engen, anything else? No. Okay. Representative Finke?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I just feel like there's a disconnect, something happening here between the conversations that we're having. This is a bill about the accommodations process, and I appreciate and wish that if people had their accommodations denied, they could file a human rights complaint, but 2024 annual survey of employees with disabilities, 74% of them reported that their accommodations requests were denied. The accommodations require, like, this is not something we just do. This is a torturous process that ultimately for most people ends up in accommodations being denied. It's nothing tricky. It just seems to be saying, I mean, this is very close to me and people that I love who have worked very hard for what any of us around this table would be considered humane accommodations for people with disabilities that are denied, and there is no recourse. So all this is saying is like, hey, that conversation itself may be discriminatory. 74% of people with disabilities are not having their accommodations fully met.
Representative Duran, and then we will close up. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might be a little naive to this, but doesn't the MHRA currently require accommodations for people with disabilities anyway?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm clearly not explaining myself. Let me try again. The HRA requires accommodations. This bill says that failure to engage in the conversation about an accommodation may be considered discriminatory. So what the HRA says, let's do an example that's really simple. If I ask you as my employer that I need an accommodation of a scooter, let's pick the thing that legislators use around here all the time, a scooter, right, to get to and from the Capitol, and you deny that request, and it's we agree on that request, you say, yes, I'll give you the scooter, and you don't give me the scooter, I can go to the HRA, okay? What this says is that if I ask for the scooter and we do not engage in the conversation, that may be discriminatory. May be discriminatory if the conversation didn't happen in good faith. That's the difference. And it is important that we understand that the granting of an accommodation and the denial of accommodation is currently illegal. The refusal to have the conversation is not currently in statute. That's what this does. Does that make sense? Did I get it this time? I'm sorry. I feel like I've answered the same question like six times, so I'm trying different ways.
All right. Representative Duran, do you have more?
I'm good.
Okay. Representative Hudson, and maybe we can move to a vote on this.
I'll be very, very brief. So I guess the disconnect, the communication disconnect here is that we're trying to figure out what changes under this language, because of everything that's been stated, that it's a public policy statement. It's the use of the word may. Even in the testimony from the Council on Disabilities, they say the HF 2380 does not create a new protected class, expand covered areas, or establish a new cause of action. It clarifies expectations, but then the clarification is the word may. So I think that's where the disconnect is here. I'm really perplexed as I detect that folks around the table are as to what it is that is being accomplished. But that said, I don't know that it's worth having a drawn out conversation about. Thank you.
Final word, Representative Hicks, and we will take a vote.
Thank you so much, everyone, for the robust discussion. We are telling you, as the disability community, that we are afraid. We are telling you that the current statute, as it is written, is not working for us to have the dialogue about accommodations. We are also telling you that we are reasonable people and understand that every conversation is sometimes not considered discriminatory because there are people who try to exploit the law. So we use may instead of must because we recognize that as well. We are telling you that we want to continue the bipartisan support that this legislature has done over and over and over again to protect people with disabilities. And I am asking you to listen to us and move this to the general register so we can protect people with disabilities. The discussion we've had today about the nuances is lovely, and we can continue to have that discussion. But at the end of the day, legislation is supposed to be working for the people that are telling you what's not working. And today they told you, and now they're asking you to act. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much, Representative Hicks. So with that, a roll call having been requested, I will renew my motion that House Bill 2380 as intended be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Chair Liebling, aye. Chair Scott.
Aye.
Chair Scott, aye. Vice Chair Finke. Aye. Finke, aye. Vice Chair Hudson.
Aye.
Hudson, aye. Representative Bliss. Bliss, aye. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Curran, aye. Representative Duran.
Aye.
Duran, aye. Representative Engen.
Aye.
Engen, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Mahmoud.
Aye.
Mahmoud, aye. Representative Mohler.
Aye.
Mohler, aye. Representative Rarick. Excused. Representative Steer.
Aye.
Steer, aye. 13.
Okay, there being 13 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you. You know, hope no one needs a hearing aid after that. Okay, I'm concerned that we're not going to probably get to our last bill, but right now we're going to take up House File 3468, Representative Hewitt, thanks for your patience. And so I'm going to move House File 3468 to get it before the committee, and we are going to lay this bill over at the author's request. So Representative Hewitt, go ahead and please present your
thank
bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you to the committee for hearing this. I'm sure I'm already hearing it in the back of my head is why do we need something more about guns? Well, I looked at this, and when people started bringing me this bill, I said, well, wow, this is an interesting bill, and I didn't understand it, but now I do. First of all, people that, including myself, that have a permit to carry already have this responsibility to report after they've been involved in a shooting. The problem with this also is that people that aren't carrier permit or people that are bystanders don't have the same obligation to render aid or to call 911. This simply would basically activate or get aid to that person that is, another misnomer is that everybody dies in a shooting. That's not true. And those that have the permit to carry or were trained that basically you're not shooting to kill, you're shooting to stop the threat. And many people are just harmed if they're in a shot. So the quicker we get that particular person care, ALS care, and I have a medic with me today from Hennepin County to talk about why that platinum half an hour in a trauma center. I had a trauma surgeon coming, but he wasn't able to make it at the last moment. So I think that's where I really want to focus this is early activation of getting care to the person that just got shot. And this isn't, again, it's unfortunate that we have to even make laws like this. This puts a civil penalty in place. Criminally, already it's there for permit carriers, but we're going to put I want to put a civil penalty in place. And this is not the first time. This has been going on for years. I've had people call me, aren't they obligated to help? Aren't someone obligated to call? And nowhere in law. And I just found out after some of these other incidences that happened in Minneapolis here that actually I as an EMT do not off-duty have an obligation to help, which I think is another bill that we should work on someday. But as you know, Jeff Backer and myself never refuse anybody regardless what aisle they sit on. So, but that's all we're doing here. And I do have a medic, Madam Chair, if I can bring him up.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee. Come on up and introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony. Thanks for your patience.
Hello, everyone. Madam Chair, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. My name is Sam Erickson. I'm the Vice President of the Hennepin County Association of Paramedics and EMTs. So we're the union that represents paramedics, BLS EMTs, and emergency medical dispatchers at Hennepin County. I've also been a paramedic serving in Hennepin County and before that in Glencoe for the past 13 years. So I just wanted to come today and speak a little bit to what we see out in the field and the importance of some of these actions as we move forward. So starting with calling 911, we don't think of it anymore, but the 911 system is somewhat revolutionary worldwide. And the fact that we can quickly get ambulances and other resources to these scenes only happens because we have people activating our 911 system. Specifically at Hennepin EMS, we have emergency medical dispatchers. So these are people trained as EMTs with expert training and giving pro QA instructions to 911 callers. So when we can get more people calling 911, these experts can be on the phone with them, instructing them in things like CPR, stop the bleed, stroke recognition, all of these important skills that save lives of Minnesotans. The dispatchers are also super important in that they get appropriate resources to scenes. Without those experts in place and without folks calling 911 because of this bill potentially, it's very hard at times to know, do we need police? Do we need fire first responders? Do we need ALS ambulances? Civilian CPR prior to ALS arrival is key to survival and positive neurologic outcome for Minnesotans who are injured in many type of ways, but specifically with shootings. CPR, stop the bleed training, those types of things improve survival outcomes, and they mean that more Minnesotans survive these situations and they leave the hospital neurologically intact, which is super important to our outcomes. We've also seen, specifically in Hennepin County, but around the state, that in large mass casualty incidents, initial civilian response and responsibility is crucially important. So when you think about situations like the 35W bridge collapse, like the shootings at Red Lake, Ricori, Annunciation, we will get resources there, but having civilians on scene who initially act and help people is, again, crucial to increasing survival odds for those folks. And it might even be something as simple as directing ALS ambulances or first responders on some of these complex scenes where it's difficult for us to know. I'll use Annunciation as an example. Annunciation School, which is just a few miles from where I grew up, there's multiple entrances, several buildings you can go from the south. And like, so having folks who are there on scene directing us as ALS providers where to go saves seconds and minutes, which ultimately can save lives. So we're here to support this bill. We think that having more requirements around some of these scenes to make sure that people, Minnesotans specifically, are getting help is crucially important. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the public who wants to testify on the bill? Not seeing anyone. So we'll close testimony. And Representative Hewitt, anything else you wanted to say?
No, I'm open for member questions.
Okay. Are there any questions? Chair Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm trying to square this bill with some of the training that we've received around here. from the Sergeant of Arms office. Run, hide, fight. Right? So how do we square that with then being potentially sued if we don't come to an injured person's help?
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair and Chair Scott, that's a great question, because in the bill it also goes into how they have to prove that you were there. Cameras do that a lot of times, but we're also talking about the Capitol's a different place for this, or schools are a different place when we're talking about this, all right? I mean, yeah, if you see something at a school and you're able to call 911 safely, you still have the utmost in any first response situation. I know there's a lot of law enforcement officers at this table, and even in our conceal class or in our carry class, you learn that you're number one. You have to protect yourself and the people around you. And that means maybe fleeing if the threat is not over. If the threat's over, then you have the obligation. You have to make sure the threat is neutralized. I hope that helps you answer the question. I guess if you're running and hiding, the threat has not been controlled yet. And that's what this is about. It doesn't take place until the threat is done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad we're laying this bill over, because I'm not sure exactly what an average bystander is going to be potentially sued for, or what their actions should be in different situations. An active shooter situation, I don't think it's not clear to me what my responsibilities would be in those situations. So I'm glad we're laying the bill over for that reason alone.
Let me go to Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Everybody's created different, right? So not every single person's going to be the same. Not every person's going to run to the threat. Not every person's going to be able to run away from the threat. There's a time where people freeze, okay? And they're in that fight, flight, or just they don't know what's going on. So would this bill actually charge those people for not being capable of actually doing something, I guess, in there? If I see someone shot and that's outside the norm of what I actually am used to, because everybody's going to be created different. So this bill is a huge concern of mine, just because of the fact that I think we're forcing people to act when sometimes they may not have the ability to, because of their own internal workings. So would this bill actually charge someone, or have the ability to have someone charged if they freeze?
Madam Chair and
Representative Hewitt.
Representative Dron, you've been in these situations, as have I, and I understand what you're going with this, and using the word charge is more not in this case. This is civil, so could they be sued if they didn't? Any reasonable court would probably look at all the circumstances, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a judge, but I would think, and hopefully, like Chair Scott said, that the bill is being laid over. There is work to do on this bill, and I would say, as a law enforcement officer, wouldn't you want to be there sooner than later? And you don't have to answer that if you don't want.
Yeah, Mr. Hopkins, maybe you could sort of explain the underlying law, because we don't have that here in front of us.
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, so Section 609.662 currently places duties on both a person who discharges a firearm and a person who witnesses the discharge of a firearm to immediately investigate the extent of any injuries that it might have caused and to render immediate reasonable assistance to the person. Violation of those duties can be a crime under the statute currently. So what the bill does is it also adds, explicitly in law, the ability to for a person injured by a violation of those duties to bring a civil lawsuit for damages.
All right, thank you. And so, maybe what we need to do here is remove the criminal penalties and substitute the civil ones. I don't know, but I was also surprised to find out that there is such a criminal penalty in law currently. I'm going to go to Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yep, and that's what I was going to do, too. I pulled up the statute, and it does have the definition for reasonable assistance, meaning aid appropriate to the circumstance, appropriate to the circumstances. And then there's also an affirmative defense. So I think for some of the scenarios that you were asking about, Chair Scott, would fall under either not meeting the definition for reasonable assistance or also be subject to the affirmative defense.
Okay. Representative Curran?
Very quickly, as someone who's not a lawyer, I would just like to say that what exactly this bill does is take language that's already in the law and provide a path for a civil cause of action. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Fraser. Oh, okay. Representative Duran, did you want to say anything more? Okay. Chair Scott?
Yeah, I mean, I look at the committee brief from nonpartisan staff, and it says, similarly, a person who witnesses the discharge of a firearm and who knows or has reason to know that that this has caused bodily harm to another person also has a duty to render assistance to the injured party. It goes beyond just calling 911. I mean, to me, it's going to that person that may be, you know, lying on the ground. It's not just, oh, I rendered assistance by calling 911. So that's what gives me concern is, like, are we going to now have an active shooter situation where everybody's going to feel the need to go rush towards an injured party that's lying on the ground and then put themselves in harm's way as well? So that's my concern.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Scott. And that's current law. And it's got a criminal penalty. And as I said, I was quite surprised to see that. But Representative Hewitt, any final word, and we're going to lay this bill over.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. I was hoping for a robust, because this needs work. I understand that. But I also think that, and that's why I brought the current paramedic up here. I don't want to bring up the name, but we all know the football player, and I actually got to ref that young man over in North Minneapolis that was gunned down on a corner that we're just dealing with his case because it was appealed. I would just like to think that that leader would be here today if someone possibly would have activated EMS quicker or got the right people to the scene. And so that's why I like this bill. I like it so we have accountability. It doesn't matter. And I'm with you, Chair Scott. Why do we need another law? But unfortunately, we do it all the time up here to legislate morality. So thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, committee.
All right. With that, House File 3468, thank you, is laid over. And apologies, Representative Feist, we're not going to get to your bill, and apologies to your testifier. We will reset that for another day. So there being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.